welcome to everybody. My name is Kathy Campbell and I'm the head of the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science. In fact, today is a very big day. Aside from our visitor, this is the very first seminar we've had as the new department. I think that many of you know Larry Aber by reputation. He's a world-leading psychologist, an internationally recognized expert in child development and social policy. He's currently based at New York University, where he's the Wilner Family Professor of Psychology and Public Policy at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education and Human Development. He's also board chair of its Institute of Human Development and Social Change. He's co-director of the International Research Center Global Ties for Children. Larry is very well known also for co-editing a volume which we all are familiar with, Neighborhood Poverty, Context and Consequences for Children. Today he's going to talk about his work on the challenges of promoting children's learning and development in very extreme settings, drawing on work he's done in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We welcome you to our department and thank you for giving the talk today.
Thank you.
So now we'll talk and then we'll take questions at the end.
Do people normally talk for about how long?
Well, how long do you want to talk for?
I get paid by the word. I'm an academic, so I can talk for 10 minutes or 10 hours.
Well, 45 minutes?
45 minutes is perfect. Yeah. 45 minutes is perfect. Hello, everybody. I also wanted to introduce my wife, Chris Pendry, who is on sabbatical with me here, and two colleagues from Darlington Social Research Unit, Luke and Shreya. So, and I'm interested and eager to meet all of you, and I am grateful for the department to sponsor me during this semester. A couple of things about my background. I don't mind being the inaugural speaker because I'm the oldest of six kids, and so I was always the first of everything, and I get blamed for almost everything, so that'll work just fine. I spent the first decade of my life in Memphis, Tennessee, where I was born, the second in Pittsburgh, where 90% of my blood relatives are from, the third in Boston, Massachusetts, where I met my life partner and bride, and the fourth, fifth, sixth, and the first half of the seventh in New York City. And if you can't tell, my speaking speed has increased every move. So I'm a New Yorker, and I'm going to go through things very fast. But I will be happy to go. If I lose you, if there's a question of clarification that you have, please interrupt me immediately. But if it's a bigger, more conceptual question, wait, and we'll have plenty of time for discussion at the end, if that's okay. Great. Okay. So, the other thing I want to say more seriously about my professional biography is I've really been obsessed by two things for the bulk of my professional career. The first is how poverty and violence in different forms and in different combinations and at different levels, from intimate violence to state systemic violence, from family poverty to neighborhood poverty, how those affect children's development and learning. They're two of the more noxious toxic experiences in children's life. But I'm not a voyeur. I don't like to do that just to get depressed. I'm especially interested in identifying sources of resilience that children exhibit, even in the face of that. What are the sources of those resilient responses? And how can we learn from that how to potentially design and rigorously evaluate programs or policies to either reduce children's exposure to poverty and violence, prevention strategies, or to strengthen them in the face of poverty and violence, more remediation strategies. I was at Columbia for 23 years before I went to NYU 12 years ago, and while I was at Columbia University, almost all of my work was domestic, 90-95% domestic. But since I've come to NYU over the last decade, now about 80% of my work, and it's on the way to 90%, is international. So I'm an old guy, but a relative novice in international work. And so I will appreciate your eyes and your critiques about what we're doing here. I'm going to begin by just mentioning that America's leading developmental psychologist of resilience, Ann Mastin, really calls out the stunning lack of evidence we have about interventions to improve things for kids in conflict-affected countries. And not just academics, but international donors. USAID decries the lack of rigorous experimental evidence, especially that uses reliable, rigorous measures, so we really know what we're doing. And London's own Mark Jordan at King's College says that, and the few experiments we have are what some of us refer to as black box experiments. Does the intervention impact the outcome? Almost nothing about mechanism. Now, I just want to see, how many of you have been involved in randomized trials of social or psychological interventions? Raise your hand, just to, so you can see. About a third, maybe a half of you. And so the half that aren't, there's been a real shift in the last 20 or 30 years toward the use of responsible experimentation in trying to discover ways to do all this. But we're way behind among the group of kids who are ostensibly among the most needy in the world, and that's kids in very poor and conflict-affected contexts. And so we're only beginning to start to build this evidence base, and that's the story I want to tell you a little bit now. Most of the research that is about kids' interventions for kids in conflict-affected countries, are about their mental health. So people say, war, mental health, war stress, PTSD, war depression, war aggression. Natural. But it turns out kids are learning, and either not or not going to school as well. There are very few studies that actually look at education-based interventions to promote children's learning and development in conflict-affected countries. And you can compare this to the United States, where a couple years ago a meta-analysis, very influential meta-analysis, was published on what are called social-emotional learning interventions in the United States. It covered about over 20 years of studies, over 200 studies, over 200,000 kids who are participating in those studies. And they, those studies have really shown that social-emotional learning-based interventions, which I'll tell you a little bit about, but interventions that help children regulate their emotions, improve their social relationships, make responsible decisions, self-regulate, not misinterpret social cues. Those kinds of things, when integrated into school, can not only improve kids' social behavior and mental health, it can also improve their academic outcomes. And so this is, I'm not holding the West up as a paragon of all the research in the world, but you've heard the 95-5 story, that 95% of psychological science's knowledge is on 5% of the world's population. And we want to try to shift that, and that's part of this story. I hope I don't have to make the case about why we want to try to understand kids affected by conflict. It has rotten outcomes for kids, but some kids are demonstrate resilience even in the face of those experiences, and that's intriguing to try to think about. And it's a two-way street. Conflict affects kids' educational and mental health outcomes, but kids' educational outcomes actually affects the probability of conflict. There's now very good research that shows that extreme inequalities over periods of time at nation level predict the probability of war. So nobody's done a random assignment of assigning ISIS to the Levant and the Red Brigade to Europe and U.S. to Trump, but we're working on it. So, but there's plenty of good reasons to do this. And over the last 10 or 20 years, there's been three major strategies that have emerged to educate children in conflict-affected countries, to improve their education. The first is to improve access to formal education systems. About half the children who are not in school, primary grade children who are not in school in the world, are not in school in conflict-affected countries. We had the Millennium Development Goals. The education goal is to achieve universal primary education by 2015. We got within about 600,000 kids in the world to that, but a little less than 600,000 kids who are not in school in the world are not in school because their countries are in conflict. And so improving access by providing safe transportation, reparations to school damage, second shift classes. Second shift, I'm going to end up telling you a little bit at the end about Lebanon. Lebanon's response to the first 100,000 kids who left Syria to come into Lebanon was to put them in seats that weren't occupied in Lebanese schools, and then to develop second shifts to move to school in the morning for Lebanese kids and school in the afternoon for Syrian refugee kids. And there are very few evaluations of those. The second is to improve access to informal education systems. So when we began talking to Lebanon about this work a couple years ago, the government really didn't want international NGOs messing around with their national education system. And so they really held the NGO community at arm's length, even though they could not provide, and it was clear that they could not provide, education for all the kids who were coming into Lebanon. So the informal education, basically they didn't want to promote the development of the informal sector, and there's a bunch of politics about that. In other places, it's possible, but community-based education in school settings that are created by communities as alternative forms of education is another way to improve access. But like what we've learned through the Millennium Development Goals, we've dramatically increased children's attendance in school globally. But there are still many multiples of children who leave primary school illiterate and innumerate. So they are attending, they have access, but they're not learning because of the quality of education. So the Sustainable Development Goals, which have replaced the Millennium Development Goals, are now focusing in their education goals in universal access to quality education and learning for all. And so it's universal access, but also the aspiration being kids, all kids learn. You just don't go there. And here there are a number of strategies: teacher training, accelerated learning programs, peace education to, in Lebanon, for instance, the Syrian kids and the Lebanese kids are in the same school, in many instances, in the same classroom. So how to increase contact and understanding among groups, and mental health interventions are all things that people are trying to use to improve the quality of formal and non-formal education systems. And there's a tiny evidence base. Evidence is beginning to emerge from a few efficacy trials of the success of some of these things. But it's very hard to draw any conclusions beyond a single study right now, partly because there's so few studies, but partly because these studies are not joined up. There's an incoherence to the design, the questions, the methodology, and until we change some of those things, we're not going to have the kind of evidence base it will take to make a difference in the world. And in terms of looking at mechanisms, moving beyond the black box experiment, there's exactly one study that looks at mechanisms. And that's an inadequate knowledge base to guide what Gordon Brown now is trying to do, is raise $2 billion a year to provide universal education, primary education for kids all around the world. So a tiny little evidence base for one great big potload of money and interventions that we're trying to mount. This has grown over in awareness over the last 4 or 5 years, but 5 years ago, the International Rescue Committee asked if I would become their academic partner in one drop, but it's a big drop, I hope, into this empty bucket. And that's to begin to understand these processes in the Democratic Republic of Congo. What I'm going to spend the next 15 minutes telling you about is the first large-scale rigorous evaluation of an education intervention in a conflict-affected country that it strove to improve classroom practices and processes to promote kids' both academic outcomes and their social-emotional outcomes. So this is a beginning attempt to look at multiple outcomes and to break out of the silos of individual disciplines to do that. It was funded at the intervention level by the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, and the Congo finally got stable enough around 2010 that they could imagine beginning to reinvest in education in the country. And so they made a $25 million competition available to NGOs to work with the Democratic Republic of Congo to revitalize 350 schools in three of the eastern provinces of the Congo. North and South Kivu and Katanga, which are along the Rwanda-Burundian-Tanzanian border. The Congo. We could spend the next half hour or 2 hours or 2 days talking about the complexities of the Congo. Do any of you know the Congo very well? Shucks, you could teach me. Somebody, yes, okay, great. I would like to talk to you later. just at 30,000 feet, a couple of really distinguishing features. The Congo had a brutal, was the epicenter of a brutal war that occurred from the early 90s through the first end of the first decade of 2000. This after years of exploitation by Belgium, very complex colonial things, but the last 25 years, acute war, some people call it Africa, it's the epicenter of Africa's world war. Several million people died. There were militia and armies from 7 or 8 different countries involved in this war, the Great Lakes War. And most of the people who died did not die from being bludgeoned or macheted or shot. They died from fleeing that into areas where they got sick and they contracted infectious diseases. So the death largely came from fleeing. You leave known death, certain death, to go to possible death, and it has those kinds of multiplying effects. But it's not over. So this is a picture of, I'm sorry you can't see it very well, of the eastern Congo along the Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Tanzanian borders. And these are instances of armed conflict in the first year we started in the study. And over the next 2 years, the number and size of the conflicts of militia incursions. So you might have heard of a militia called M23. M23 invaded Kivu and shut it down for a while. And so as if armed conflict isn't enough, in 2012, the year after we started, this is my favorite graph in all of social science. On the x-axis is income per person in log terms. So this is 500, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, $50,000 of income per person per year, okay? And this is life expectancy, and it goes from 50 to 80. And you can see that the country in the world that has the lowest income, so low that it's not on the graph, and the lowest life expectancy is the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2012. So it has the lowest human development index and is challenging for those reasons. And then finally, I'm not sure exactly how many indigenous languages there are spoken in the Congo. Maybe no one does. But it's safe to say they're in three digits. There's hundreds, okay? There are four major national languages, and they're graphed onto these localities. You can see in the eastern Congo, the dominant language is Kiswahili. But there's been so much movement among peoples during this period of time that it's like Noah's Ark. Or the Tower of Babel. Got my biblical references wrong. Where everybody's speaking another language and it's hard to build this. So the language diversity is enormous. Suffice it to say that the language of instruction in Congolese schools is French, because they were a Belgian Congo, their Belgian colony. You are instructed in your mother tongue in first grade and instructed in French an hour a day in first grade. And then instruction begins in French in second grade. So I don't know how many of you would relish 1 year of 1 day, 1 hour a day instruction in one language and then have to leave your mother tongue to be instructed in the second grade. But that's the language diversity of all these things. So there's the issue of the relationship between mother tongue and language of instruction as a kind of issue. This is the very broadest social, political, economic context of Congo in which this work is being placed. But the Ministry of Education in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the International Rescue Committee, and USAID wanted to start a policy initiative, a five-year policy initiative, called Opportunities for Equitable and Quality Learning for All. That's close to what the real title is. Its initials are definitely OPEC, O-P-E-Q. And this is a major policy initiative that there was a lot of policy development and implementation support to change schools at the local level. There was a lot of school and community mobilization and engagement, shifting of school and community norms and functionings before you get to the school itself. So what I'm wanting to emphasize is that I'm going to tell you about a randomized trial that is embedded in a policy initiative. And the randomized trial is an experiment, but the policy initiative is not experimental, and yet it sets up the conditions and the contingencies in which the experiment occurs. And it is basically about how an integrated social-emotional learning program called Learning and Healing Classrooms that has been in development by the International Rescue Committee for about 2 decades changes teacher motivation and performance, school climate, and classroom ecologies to improve kid outcomes. And that's the tail end of this policy theory of change. Learning and Healing Classrooms, you can Google, go to IRC's website, you can see the programmatic work. But it basically is two elements. There's an integrated curriculum with a social-emotional focus. So they teach high-quality literacy and numeracy instruction. They strive to improve the quality of instruction of literacy and numeracy, but doing it in a way that simultaneously integrates social-emotional learning principles. What are social-emotional learning principles? They're reduced corporal punishment. So no holding a rod and smacking kids. They're the use of positive discipline. They are the creation of cooperation among students instead of the colonial system was you have a whole bunch of kids coming into a classroom. You don't teach them anything. The kids who are smartest and toughest survive, and you make them run the government. That's the old colonial model of, and it's more complicated than that, but it makes my point. The cooperation, learning for all, were not part of the colonial ethos. It was education to identify an elite that would help you do things. So and then there's an in-service teacher training to drive these principles through. You get trained in this integrated curriculum, and then it's drawing on old Congolese practices of teacher learning circles where teachers in contiguous grades met once a week in a group, in a whole school met once a month, and in a cluster of schools met once a quarter. And so these teacher learning circles, TLCs, are the vehicle through which the initial training is driven through the process. One slide, not that simple. It's enormously complicated to do this, and maybe I'll have a chance to talk to you. This is now the theory of change for the impact evaluation of learning and healing classrooms. So what's going to happen is that some schools and communities are going to get assigned to learning and healing classrooms. The idea is social developmental ecology is that if you change kids' perceptions of their learning environments in a positive direction, if the kids see their schools as safe, supportive, cooperative, predictable, orderly, coherent, and you change teacher motivation and well-being. One example, the average Congolese teacher's salary is 25 to 35% of what it takes to live a subsistence life for a family in the Congo. So they make a fourth or a third of what would be, in our mind, a poverty level. And people wonder why teachers only teach sometimes. Why? So a lot of teachers have a little patch of ground where they're growing vegetables. They have a little stall at a market. they're doing other things, and there's huge teacher absence. So how do you motivate and improve teacher well-being to improve their academic skills and their social emotional learning? You can't study everything in academics or social emotional learning, so we're focusing on reading and math skills, and on two key features of children's social emotional functioning: their mental health and their experiences of victimization, which are thought to be related from all this other research to war. So, three big questions: what's the causal impact of this intervention on these four things? Kids' perceptions, teacher motivation, well-being, kids' academic skills, kids' social emotional outcomes. And those of you who do experiments know that you can really only, this is a little overly animated, so I'm just going to explain it. You can actually attain experimental impacts, these four experimental impacts, accurately through a random assignment experiment. But these indirect effects, these mediated effects, you can't. You can approach it, and I'll talk about that a little bit, but that's the theory of change. So we don't yet have a scientific methodology actually to study causal mediation. And that's a big set of issues for the science. So what's the impact? Do they go indirectly? And then what about the heterogeneity impact? Does it work equally well for boys and girls, or for language minority kids and language majority kids, or schools with very low base rates of achievement at the beginning or higher base rates of achievement, or in communities with more violence or less violence? So those kind of heterogeneity of impact questions. The Congo is about the size geographically of the United States east of the Mississippi. It's the largest, now that Sudan's been broken up, it is the largest landmass in Africa. It's about the size of the old Western Europe. It's a big place. Capital is in Kinshasa, way over here in the west, and the epicenter of the conflict was over here in the east. And the IRC is a very ambitious but a small enough NGO that they could not roll out things with quality in 350 schools across the equivalent of 17 states spatially. With dirt roads and bad transportation. So rather than just do it poorly forever, they have decided to really rigorously randomize when the intervention is rolled out over several years. So what we implemented is a randomized waitlist control design at the school cluster level as an ethical but scientific way to ask the question, what's the impact? So you don't want to withhold services, but they didn't have the institutional capacity or resources to roll out services in all 350 schools at the beginning. So if you apportion when schools start by lottery, by community lottery, I have great pictures of us going and having red, yellow, and green balls, and you pull out, the community leader pulls out a ball from a sack, and if it's green, you start in 2011. If it's yellow, you start in 2012. And if it's red, you start in 2013. And that's the way the assignment intervention was assigned. We started, the randomization occurs within education subdivisions, but also staggered by cohort. So we began in these four education subdivisions in 1 year and expanded to these three in the next. And that leads to this kind of design. In those four places, we began in 2011. So at the end of 2012, we had data on 1 year of learning and healing classrooms versus no years of learning and healing classrooms. And we hadn't even moved to Kivu yet. You follow it for another year, and there were a group of schools that were assigned to either 2 years or 1 year, or no years, and we're calling that an expansion year versus a rollout year. And in that same year, then we began the first time in the Kivus. And so, and then by the school year 14-15, all schools were getting the services. So there was never a withholding of treatment. There was a delay in the receipt of treatment for the purposes of learning. And we're going to have three experimental contracts. We're going to say, what does it look at like after a year of intervention in one set of subdivisions? What does it look like after 1 year of intervention in a replication subset of subdivisions? And what does it look like after 2 years in the place that we began to begin with? And for those of you who are more familiar with the kind of experimental flow diagrams that journals require now, this is the experimental flow diagram that basically says the same thing that I just said. Let me pause for a second. Is the experimental design is a combination of politics, ethics, and science, and rather important. So I just want to linger. You don't have to agree with it or like it, but I don't want you to be confused by it. Is there any clarification I can make on the experimental design before I go on? Okay. You're kind. We're not paying attention.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you call it a combination of science, politics, and ethics? I'm very curious by that statement.
Of science, because the power of experimentation won't work if you if things get contaminated. Okay, so. For instance, the intervention happens at the level of school clusters. One trainer trained the 2 to 6 schools within a day's walk or a moped trip. So, and there was this history, administrative history, of the 2 to 6 schools meeting together to share resources, okay? If you assign things at the school level, you would have had contamination within the cluster. So you had a... those are some... And remember, you analyze at the level you randomize. So we're gonna, I'm going to end up showing you that there's 75 school clusters. That's like doing an experiment with 75 people. They're big things. They're multiple schools in the clusters, and there's thousands and thousands of kids. But you have 75 things that you've randomized. So... issues of power, issues, there's a whole bunch of scientific issues that are related to it. Politics, Chiefs wanted to know, why is Martin's school starting this year and Kathy's school starting next year? You know, that's, so the transparency of the community lotteries ended up being very important politically. And also to say, you have two choices. We can try to start everything in 350 schools and it'll suck in year one, or we can do this over 3 years and make it better in each of the 3 years. That's kind of the politics, the ethics of it. I hate depriving kids of service. I don't think anybody who is in this game likes it. And yet we're saying, in these communities you wait for a year, in these communities you wait for 2 years. There better be something pretty damn special about what you're doing if you're going to do that. Or pretty damn practical. And I think there is something special and practical in these cases. But does that answer your question, Sam?
Totally.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. So I think you get the contrast now. So as I said, about 75 school clusters. We sampled one school when the school clusters were nationally under 3 or under, 3 schools or less. We sampled 2 schools in clusters that were 4 to 6 in size. So we were sampling a third or a half of the schools from different sizes of the natural clusters, and about 3,500 to 4,500 kids participated in the study, and over 300 teachers. In these parts of the Congo, 75%, roughly 70-75% of the teachers were males. They were almost 40 on average, and they had a dozen or more years of experience on average. So these were not rookie teachers on average. This was Congo's old teaching corps. Men, middle-aged men, okay, not women. And I could spend another 60 minutes talking to you about measure development. But suffice it to say that we did this study for, we raised $500,000 to begin with, and then we raised another $500,000. So $1 million, I don't know how many of you do budgets for these kinds of things, but it's hard to do a study of this scale for that amount of money. We had to use child self-report as the major way of getting measures of how kids felt about their schools and teachers and their mental health and victimization. We're now going to try to develop scenario-based and performance-based measures of many of these things because of the limits to self-reports. But self-reports is standard practice if you do it right. The academic outcomes we assessed using the EGRA and the EGMA, the Early Grades Reading Assessment and the Early Grades Math Assessment, which has been developed by by Research Triangle Institute for USAID. And it includes 9 different subscales of these, and they're ordered from easy to hard, and you assess kids on about 5 of them, depending on where you think they are. So it only actually takes about 15 minutes to assess kids' reading and math. Partly because there's so many zeros. So this is children's scores. In blue is second grade, green is third grade, red is fourth grade on the things. And you see that while there were very few zero scores in vocabulary, initial sound identification, the beginning identification of a phoneme, which is the basis of the transition from oral to written reading and language instruction, 80% of the kids could not identify an initial sound in French.
French.
Oui, exactement. Not in Kikongo or Kiswahili. That's exactly right. A little better with the letters, the written form of it, graphemes, etc. But the thing that USAID and the world reading movement now take as the standard is reading comprehension, reading a paragraph and being able to answer something about it. That is considered the minimal standard of literacy. And you see that 80% of fourth graders got zero on the reading comprehension in French, demonstrating the point. So there's things you have to do about that kind of stuff. First of all, there's too many outcomes and they're too correlated. And so you want to do data reduction and look at latent variables. And if you do that through factor analysis, you can actually get it down to 3 factors. A reading factor, which all of those subscales load on, and 2 math factors, addition, subtraction, and geometry. And geometry shapes, I suppose it's about math, but it's not about numeracy. So complex, how many of you know who Yuri Bronfenbrenner is? Only about a 30, that's interesting, okay. So Yuri was an Russian-born American developmental psychologist who wrote probably one of the 2 most influential books of my career when I was at your age. It was called The Ecology of Human Development. And he really has a developmental ecological perspective. And he generated theories and hypotheses that it took us 40 years to be able to test because there weren't measures at higher levels of the ecology and there weren't mathematics to study, to model dynamic, complex, multi-level phenomena. So hierarchical linear modeling, dynamic modeling, is necessary to evaluate complex social interventions. And I hope and pray that we got the equations right. I think we did, but these are the equations that allow us to now, I'm going to summarize the results. And I'm going to use the form of the theory of change to summarize them. I'm not going to show you a bunch of tables and graphs, but there's papers that will do this. But what impact did learning in healing classrooms have on these 2 sets of mediating mechanisms and these 2 sets of children's developmental outcomes? And we're going to answer the question 3 times. Once for the first cohort after 1 year, once for the second cohort after 1 year, and once for the first cohort after 2 years. Okay? After 1 year. Pretty cool. Yeah. So some of you can't see the sign. We'll say, gosh, okay, the first part of the theory of change works. they're changing kids' perceptions of how caring and supportive and their schools and teachers are and how predictable and cooperative they are. But those of you who can squint will see something bad. And that's the negative coefficient on the predictable and cooperative. So we changed it, but we made it worse. So we improved kids' caring perceptions of their schools as caring and supportive in the first year, but we actually reduced their perception of how predictable and cooperative the school was. Not what we wanted. No effect on teachers, motivation or burnout or job dissatisfaction, except that that's not quite true when I get to heterogeneity of effects, no main effects. Positive effects on reading and geometry, but not on mental health systems or victimization. So, half a loaf. We had impact on kids' perceptions of their school ecologies, on their academic outcomes, but not on their social emotional outcomes. Exact same analysis. Oops. And the heterogeneity is there's no main effect of the intervention on teachers. But for teachers who were relatively inexperienced, there was a positive effect on their motivation. So the teachers who were 12 years out, the egg had already been scrambled. You weren't going to unfry the egg. But for the earlier teachers, they're still sitting in the pan. You just cracked it open, and you can either scramble it or do it sunny side up. They're still open to change. And additionally, there's a crossover effect. Said in English, the reason we had no average effect on teachers is because we had a positive effect on the men and a negative effect on the women teachers in opposite directions. In a very gendered part of the world where three quarters of the teachers in the leading teacher learning circles were men. So it was different to be a woman teacher in this intervention than it was to be a man teacher in this intervention. The second cohort, hallelujah, we flipped the sign. And not only did we improve kids' perceptions of their schools as caring and supportive, but also as predictable and cooperative. And we see the first one as true, but due to the chaos of learning how to do this for the IRC. And the other effects are pretty much the same. No effects, no average impacts on teachers. Good impacts on reading and math achievement, but no impacts on mental health outcomes. These are all a little bit bigger in effect size, you'll see in a minute. So the really bad news is if you follow the first cohort into the second year, all of the positive effects got wiped out. So half a loaf, no loaf is the shorthand version of the story. And, sir.
Larry, is that relative to point one or point zero, like before you started? So there's no, like there was no change from, or did it actually go back to baseline?
More or less they went back to baseline, but because you're modeling intervention and development at the same time, you wouldn't see that in the raw numbers.
Right. I mean, they're going up the way they would normally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Before I try to make sense of this for a couple minutes, I want to remind you of the third research question, which is there any evidence that these changes in kids' perceptions of their ecologies are actually part of the mechanism by which the intervention affects the outcome? And this is multi-level structural equations modeling, and basically what it says is two things we knew already. Yes, learning in yielding classrooms improves kids' caring and support, perceptions of care and support from their schools and teachers, and has a negative effect on the other ecological feature of predictable and cooperative learning environments. These two offset each other, and actually when you model them together, you actually find a positive indirect effect of the intervention on geometry and on victimization. This is using data from year one, okay, from the first cohort. So, but we'd have to call these plausibly causal because this this is an experimental estimate, this is an experimental estimate, this is not. This is a correlation in the underlying mathematics of it. And what we want to get to eventually is true causal analysis, if we possibly can, both for theory development and also for the practical parts of replication. There's almost nothing more important to know about a program than how it works. What are the actual mechanisms by which it works? And if we can learn those fundamental principles, that dramatically improves our ability to replicate this kind of work. So, in summary, during the rollout phase in the first set of subdivisions, we improved literacy by effect size. As everybody knows, that effect size is the mean difference between two groups by the average or control group standard deviation. These effect sizes actually, in the second cohort, the effect sizes went up a little. But Patrick McEwen, an economist in the United States, did a huge meta-analysis of interventions to improve academic learning in the 75 randomized trials that existed up till a couple of years ago. And he finds that among the few interventions that work, the average effect size is a bit between 0.08 and 0.12. So what we've got isn't very powerful. This is at least as good or a little better. And if there were 200 studies, we'd kind of say what the U.S. meta-analysis said. Social-emotional learning can actually improve academic outcomes. But this is the first demonstration of it. So we're the first demonstration plus one replication. What do we learn from this? First, that we can actually do this kind of work at relative scale. Working in 350 schools in very complex political and physical terrain over 3 or 4 years is not an efficacy trial. It's not a trial under optimal conditions, a small hothouse garden boutique intervention. This is an intervention in the real world. And I think that that's the kind of science we should be doing now. The improvements in school environments plausibly lead to these. So there's something about school environments that we should continue to be building on. And the size of the impact is good. But if we had that size of impact, kids would still not be graduating from grade school literate and numerate. If you turn these into years of months of growth, the effect we had on reading was about the equivalent of 3 to 4 months of growth in reading. And in math, about 9 or 10 months in math. That sounds good until you remember that this is Congolese school growth. It's very, very low intercept and very slow growth. So we are accelerating growth by a quarter of a year or three quarters of a year, but against a very low and slow, low base rate and slow rate. And that's not enough to make the world literate. And so we have to do something about that. The size of the impact is simply not enough to meet the children's needs in these contexts. During the expansion year, the year to Congo, all these things faded out. And why do we think that's the case? Well, the first is we learned retrospectively that because of budget cuts, they ended up serving twice as many schools with the exact same number of staff. We think the most parsimonious explanation is that the schools didn't continue to receive the level and quality of support they got because you cut the training and coaching that IRC was able to provide in half. We weren't able, because we only raised $500,000 to begin with, we weren't able to collect high-quality implementation data. So that's our hypothesis, but we got bupkis to say about it. That's a technical term in New York City that means nothing in Yiddish. We know nothing about that, and my biggest regret is that we don't have any implementation data to confirm or deny this notion of why we've got the fade-out effects. But what we do know is that we need to really redouble our efforts for continuous quality improvement. It's not you find something that works and you simply replicate it. If you replicate it, it's going to go down. and you have to plan to help it not go down through processes of continuous quality improvement that ideally should be research-based as well. I'm almost done. Disappointingly, in both cohorts, we didn't have any effects on victimization or mental health. And we think there are several reasons for that. We think that changing children's school climates are a necessary but not sufficient condition to create improvements in mental health and victimization. That it's too light and generic an intervention. And we think that there are also other processes that could have counteracted some of this on the mental health side. So for instance, I showed you the conflict was continuing to grow over the period of time. We're going to try to do a spatial analysis where we see if rates of growth in conflict in a community moderated the impact of the intervention. And so maybe in the non-conflict areas, it didn't fade out. And in the conflict areas, it had a reverse effect. We just don't know. But those are some of the kinds of questions we're going to ask and answer. And perhaps just learning in healing classroom needs some fundamental redesign. What we've now embarked on, which I'm not going to go into, is a new 5-year effort with the International Rescue Committee called Education in Emergencies, Evidence for Action. It's going to build on the work in the Congo to basically create a 3-country, maybe 4 or 5-country, 3-year, maybe 5 or 6-year research agenda of cumulative knowledge generation to answer, to replicate some of the things we found, adapt some of the things we found, answer further questions. And there are about 20 countries in the world that IRC has education programs. We're going to focus on Lebanon, Niger, and Sierra Leone. And we are going to continue to work in the Democratic Republic of Congo, too. So, and we're going to go through rapid cycles of designing things, prototyping them, testing them, revising them, and going into the next cycle over 3 years. So waiting for 4 or 5 years for a randomized trial is not science at the pace or with the urgency that the world needs. So we're going to try to accelerate our learning processes. And one of the main things we're going to do is to try to continue to build on that, opening up that black box. All of the interventions are based on already basic knowledge we have about how violence, punitive environments, and instability affect outcomes. And we're now developing a much broader set of mediators, neurobiological, cognitive, social information processing, emotion regulatory at the intra-individual level, and a bunch of things at the inter-individual level. And learning in healthy classrooms only affected some of those, but we're developing now targeted short-term interventions to target some of these new mediators that we think are critical to having effects, especially on the mental health outcomes, but also to accelerate the learning outcomes. So low-cost targeted interventions that include things like mindfulness-based practices. So mindfulness-based practices are about when was the Buddha born? But many, many countries, many, many epochs, mindfulness-based practices have been fundamental, and games. But these are games that are actually thought to be targeting executive function skills, working memory, flexibility of attention deployment, ability to inhibit a prepotent behavioral response, a bunch of things like that. There's a lot of work to do related to this, that it's not just the evaluation research, but the implementation and measurement research to get there. And we have specific plans in all 3 of these countries, which I will leave the PowerPoint with the department so anybody wants to see those. And it's all to be continued. None of this work could be done without many, many colleagues in many, many places. And we thank them for that. And there's a bunch of papers if you don't believe me. if you do believe me. Thanks very much.
Larry, thank you for a very interesting talk. It covers a huge amount of scope.
I promised you I was a New Yorker, so I talked fast and too much.
It was true. Okay, I'll just, before I open it up for questions, I'll just make a couple of comments. I've been involved in the evaluation of schools-based programs in Zimbabwe, and what we've often found is that the people from Imperial College come in and do huge randomized control trials and draw all sorts of conclusions about the success or otherwise of the programs. But they assume that the programs have been implemented properly. And I think you touched on that a bit, that often, in fact, the programs are not implemented properly, and that it's really important in these kinds of studies to have quite a detailed monitoring and evaluation of the progress of the programs as they go along performance. But I mean, I think you agree.
I completely agree, yes. But I would caution that if you call it monitoring and evaluation, the NGOs and the research groups mean, what does USAID or DFID require that we count? Not, are we implementing the quality ingredients that are central to achieving the change? So monitoring and evaluation is bean counting, and I'm not against it, but 90% of the money that is currently spent on bean counting for accountability should be devoted to real implementation research, in my opinion. And until we make that transition, we're not going to be anywhere. But you're right.
I think that in some sense, before one evaluates a program, one has to know very surely that it's been implemented properly. And that
there I disagree. That's the traditional model. Do not evaluate an intervention before it's time. Make sure it's mature. Make sure you've implemented it right. Well, then, you can just leave off, most of these places. We are not, or they're going to be so tiny and boutique that they're going to have very low generalizability, external validity. So I think the responsibility, instead of waiting until you know you can implement it right, is to evaluate variation in whether you're implementing it and use that in the analysis and the interpretation. We may not be far off, but there are plenty of people who believe what you said, and I disagree with them. I don't know if I disagree with you.
So what I'm saying is that a factor in your analysis has to be the differential quality of implementation in each school.
Yes.
I think that's all. But listen, let's
No, no, and that's what this is about.
Perfect.
This is about treatment contrast. So this is the treatment as intended, this is the treatment as received, this is the impact on the mechanisms, and this is the impact on the outcomes. And you have to be able to compare all of those. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, the treatment contrast is everything. And so people treat getting the intervention or not as 0-1, when it's often 30%, 70%. That the settings that aren't getting your intervention are implementing 30% of the things that you would want them to implement anyway, and the ones who are implementing your intervention aren't implementing at 100%, they're implementing at 70%. So the treatment contrast is the critical thing. I couldn't agree more.
Okay, who wants to follow on? Comments or questions from anybody else? Sandra?
I was wondering, we just came from a culture class, so I have culture in my mind. How would you think about the culture problem in this type of intervention? Because clearly, they have a local culture, they have a way of thinking about education that is not necessarily how we think about it. It's not schooling, it might be, I don't know, the Congo,
right.
But they have their local culture. So are we working with or against local culture here? I don't want to idealize local culture. I think
It's a great question and a very important question.
You know, how do we deal with that local culture issue here in this kind of situation?
Three quick responses, and there could be many longer responses. The International Rescue Committee has 1,000 people working in the Congo, 75 expats and 925 Congolese. So the minister, we have co-constructed the theory of change and the measures with the Congolese staff of the IRC and the Congolese Ministry of Education. We're not coming in and imposing. We are bringing prior research and methods saying, here's what we know, but we're also co-constructing the studies with the ministry and with Congolese staff in the IRC. That's probably the most important process thing. It's not complete. You'd ideally love to do lots of qualitative research before you get started. Lots of qualitative research during it. Cognitive interviewing to test all the idiosyncratic responses to the items. If you saw the internal reliabilities of the children's self-report scales. They may not be constructs that are identical to what kids are walking around their head in, but they're internally coherent. They report mental health symptoms in an internally coherent way. They report perceptions of their school cultures and ecologies in an internally coherent way. They were lawfully related to each other. So I believe that the measures we used of kids' ecologies and kids' mental health and victimization outcomes are as culturally valid as they are in the United States. They have the same level of internal reliability, they have the same level of predictive validity, and parents don't want kids beating each other up there. They don't want them to be pushovers, and they want them to cooperate in certain ways. On a much broader level, the introduction of social-emotional learning into education in Africa is experienced by almost all the African governments I've been working with as a return to a more Africanist belief in what education should do. Education should develop character and the whole person and the role of the individual in their community and not simple academic success. USAID, my nation's foreign aid department, is moronic in its laser focus on reading. Everything is reading. And they have so much money and influence that they're driving certain kinds of development ideas. But the introduction of social-emotional learning and the use of teacher learning circles and a variety of things like that are steps in a good direction, but it's all inadequate. The quantitative parts of the analysis are inadequate. The qualitative parts are inadequate. The cultural analysis is inadequate. Get on with it, is my... So, a partial but heartfelt response.
Just as a general concept, you could say the success of an intervention, one factor of its success may be defined at the rate how quickly the intervention is no longer needed.
Uh-huh.
How do you kind of model that in terms of, because this is a very programmatic type of intervention, hugely complex, when you start seeing the benefits and you start switching off the engine, so to speak?
Your question is at the heart of what I think our collective fields, one of their biggest challenges is, how do you take evidence-based interventions, even pretty big complex ones, and scale them to policy level? And how do you study the systems factors, the cultural, political, social, economic factors that constrain or enable the faithful take-up of evidence-based approaches? This actually, DFID has a program called RISE. Is it RISE? It's about systems research in education and development. But they're inadequate. They've funded trials and they've funded systems research, but the middle ground of meeting, both conceptually and methodologically, has not been approached. So the truth is, that's a decade's work that we have to undertake, and we have to undertake it quickly. If you have ideas, may I buy you a cup? I'm so far buying the gentleman in front of you a cup of coffee to learn about Congo. I'd like to buy you a cup of coffee or tea. I think you'll always be a caffeinator. So, great question.
Any other comments and questions, Jennifer?
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot I'm still processing, but in particular I was thinking about the kind of lack of effect on the psychosocial outcomes, and in particular how either the intervention or ways of measuring what's going on in the intervention could help better map out that pathway. And obviously you can't measure everything, but I was expecting you to say, when you talked about the fact that it had mostly been mental health studied, that you were going to move to more what we consider, I'm not sure if the term is psychosocial, but maybe social-psychological, things such as a sense of autonomy or to the extent to which your relational needs, thinking of self-determination theory, some of these things are met. That was one thing on the deep end of variable side. Then I was thinking about the pathways as well. Maybe there's different pathways of what's going on. Maybe it's not just perceptions of what's going on at the school level. Even though the intervention's at the school level, there may be something that's happening in a Bronfenbrenner-esque way because of perceptions of what's going on at the national level. To the extent that you've got because you're measuring victimization as a dependent variable, I'm assuming that you're talking about the conflict in some way in these healing classrooms. So maybe perceptions of intergroup relations, or perceptions of how I fit in my community, or my community relations, maybe that might be one way of getting it. And then lastly, I was thinking about one trap that we often fall into when we're trying to do culture right, is that we still nevertheless are measuring at the individual level all of the outcomes. And so maybe also a mediator could be at the group level of the actual cooperativeness in the classroom, some kind of measures of cohesion or something.
Yep. Three great comments, and I'll work backwards because of memory. Setting level phenomena, extra individual level phenomena, directly measured or estimated through aggregation. So you can be an aggressive kid in a highly aggressive classroom, or an aggressive kid in a less aggressive classroom, and you need to measure aggression at both levels to be able to determine that, and you can keep going up in the Bronfenbrenner hierarchy. The doctoral program I work in at NYU, we teach, as well as psychometrics, we teach sociometrics about reliable measures of supra-individual phenomena. And so, for instance, the reliability of a classroom-level aggression and the reliability of individual-level aggression are not the same at all. Mathematically, or it's much harder to get reliable measures at the setting level for a variety of reasons. So that was your, I agree with your last point, and it needs to be taken into account. Your second point, which is you thought we were maybe going to more, I would say, normal developmental, social, psychological, other theoretical constructs for outcomes and pathways, like from self-determination theory. Again, if we had money and collaborators, we would do that. If our on-the-ground partners agreed to it. So the on-the-ground partners are interested in those things, but they're especially interested in mental health first. So we partly prioritize what we're going to study, as I said, in a co-constructed way. And we say, well, you know, remember then, we're only looking at negative outcomes, not positive differences in positive outcomes. And they say, yeah, we know, and maybe we'll get that there the next time. I forget your first one.
Well, it was the second one, but it was whether we could think about other mediators, because perhaps the healing classroom are changing not only perceptions of the classroom, but perceptions of the wider society of my fit in the community.
My sense is over the last 10 or 15 years, measures of intergroup understanding and conflict have improved. I have not, that's critical. One of the things I'll mention is that one of the moderating effects is language minority kids do better than language majority kids. And this is an equity producing intervention. So the kids who are language minority, everybody goes up in academics and perceptions of the school. The language minority kids go up faster than the language majority kids. And I think looking at whether interventions are equity producing or equity exacerbating it is a really important thing to do. There's so many mediators. So many mediators. And so little time that you really have to be as theoretical and prudent. But it also requires the social organization of research. No single study is going to develop the evidence that's adequate to inform this area. So we are insufficiently socially organized as a research sector to act. So right now we have the unfortunate habit of being driven by the old tenure system, which is it's got to be your question and your unique contribution to it. And that actually mitigates against team science in the social and behavioral sciences. And so I think we're going to have to change some things if we're going to develop a socially organized culture of research where we're not all doing little things that are hard to accumulate, but that we're doing things that are more synergistic and robust. That's a process answer to a very important question. Martin.
Oh, maybe Deepa.
Well, it's a little bit of a follow-up to this, your question. You were mentioning like moderators on the individual level, but the focus was a kind of more kind of a cluster-level analysis. And I was wondering, like, could you look at some cluster-level moderators? Because you started your talk with the
important... Yes, there's those 10, have those 10 papers up there. There's these 10 papers that have some of it in it.
Yeah.
One example is another reason it's an equity promoting intervention is that children in schools with lower baseline scores at the school level of achievement do better, that faster than children in schools at relatively mm-hmm. higher levels. So, school baseline aggregate achievement score mm-hmm. moderates the impact of this in an equity-producing way.
Could you look at exposure to conflict? Of course, they've all been in conflict, but there can't be variation.
So, the mm-hmm. map at the beginning that I showed you of these expanding conflict areas is from a thing called OCLED, the mm-hmm. Armed Conflict, blah, 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 mm-hmm. Which is a aggregator of media and other and government reports of conflict worldwide. It's a database, and we've geocoded all the schools, and we are in the process of trying to look at levels and rates of change of violence in surrounding communities as moderating the intervention. Our concern is the quality of that OCLED data. We just don't know about it. It's a good citizen reporting mechanism, mm-hmm. whether it's adequate for scientific purposes. It's not like the Centers for Disease Control, homicide or suicide or crime rates in advanced countries. So,
yeah.
I'm especially interested in setting level moderators.
Okay, and then secondly, you were showing that disappointingly the treatment didn't hold in the second wave. But did you look at, and then you were discussing this idea that it's hard to look at this mediation because it's not experimental, the link between the mediator and the DV is not designed. But if you have this longitudinal design, couldn't you look at the links between the climate perceptions in time one and climate perception of time two?
There are things you can do that can make things increasingly plausibly causal.
But did you find anything there? Because that could kind of...
Not yet. We haven't done that analysis. That's a great idea. I haven't rushed to do it because those kinds of designs are best done with larger samples and more than three waves of time. Mm-hmm. It's the real data we have mm-hmm. constrain the value we could get out of the form of analysis that you're describing. Yeah. But it's still the right question. Yeah.
And the findings might be less disappointing. Like you were saying, that it's disappointing that you didn't find that. Maybe there is something there.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's true, but it's, if disappointment is real and not artifactual, I consider that good science, identifying disappointing findings. I'm not against null findings. Journals are, but I'm not. If you're not using a my greatest example is to see whether a medicine reduces a fever, and you're using a broken thermometer. If you're using a broken thermometer, shame on the researcher. The instrument has to be sensitive to real change. But if the instrument's sensitive to real change, and your design is solid, and your inferences are solid, the inferential logic is solid, it's very important to learn what doesn't work so that you can adapt in the real world to make it work. So, madam.
Sorry, it was Mark going to...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm
doing the American thing where the speaker decides who to talk. So Kathy is now my boss. Mark.
I'd like to take the opportunity to reflect a little bit more, to challenge you a little bit more to reflect on the politics of randomized control trials.
The what?
The politics that might be involved, or what the research might mitigate that. I was at a meeting earlier this year on science-related and democracy, and somebody introduced Obama's technocracy. And he said four things characterize Obama's technocracy. Evidence-based, behavioral focus, open government, big data.
Open government
and big data.
Big data.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, there is a kind of a context within which things are desirable, and the gold standard seems to be randomized control trials. It comes up in many cases, but maybe it's older. But I'm just curious. I think this comes from, correct me if I'm wrong, this comes out of pharmacology, where you develop a new pill, and then you want to find out the effectiveness and the gradient in relation to dosage, in relation to some kind of outcome. But I can understand the pharmacists, they don't want to talk to you, they just want to take the blood and then check it. Okay. But I suspect in a randomized control trial, it's much more complicated to have an equivalent of a pill.
Because you deal with
exactly, you deal with a cognitive context.
Yeah.
So I wonder, if you
implement, they don't either.
Yeah, and if you implement the randomized control trial, you must have a dispositive of qualitative data. What dispositive do you have for qualitative data? Do you just put it aside and then tell the story without it?
So,
or do you
this
have
is an enormously important set of issues, and there are partisans on multiple sides of this issue. Let me unpack it into three brief things. I believe the worst offenses of the misuse of experimentation are slowly being identified and corrected at the ethical level and the design and conduct of it, but also at the ethical and political level in terms of the repression of null results. So the file drawer problem in pharmacology is huge. You know, people run 100 trials and they report the two that are significant. Science journals in medicine now require the pre-registration of the trials. Mm. And this week, the science journals in political and social and behavioral science are beginning to adopt the same thing. Mm. They're not going to publish trials that have not been pre-registered. And in the pre-registry, you specify what your hypothesis, your primary hypothesis, your primary outcomes, the analysis you're going to do.
My worry is not about that bureaucracy. My worry is about what you as a real-life researcher, with your experience, and born from Brendan Reedy, what you have in dispositive as qualitative research that accompanies your statistical model.
You're using a word that I can't understand. Dispositive, is that?
You plan to talk to people for some purpose. You go there, you open your eyes, you see the contour.
Yes.
And then you implement your statistics and you model it. To what extent is it part of the implementation to recognize that the qualitative research is necessary in order to inform the research, or do you ignore it later for the purpose of following
a
gold standard?
In an ideal world, mixed methods would absolutely be the right method. In an ideal world. In the world of real funding of development projects, USAID announced that this competition was available in June of 2010. The applications were due in August of 2010. They notified IRC of winning in November of 2010, and they required by contract baseline data collection in March of 2011. That means you already have to have qualitative researchers on the ground having done a year or two of work to inform it before. It also means that you have to have pre-identified qualitative researchers to be your partners in that. We're now identifying qualitative researchers to accompany us in rapid response to these things. But this is part of what I mean by the social organization of research. It is not possible to do that unless we change business. It's the right thing to do, in my opinion. I'm an avid supporter of mixed methods, and I am a sharp criticizer of the limits of quantitative and experimental methodology without it. Having said that, I'm a pragmatist, and the chance to learn this, we took nakedly, without the very important accompanying work that should go on with it, and that has to change. And all I can say is I'm aware of it and I'm working on it. So, and if you have companions and confreres who wish to join, let me know. So I think it's very, very important. You raise some more macro political and ideological issues too.
Don't worry about that.
Well, I'm going to worry about it for 1 second because some people think that experiments are reductionist. And in a way,
interventionist.
They are.
They're interventionist. You've tweaked.
Right, right.
Have you tried your thing?
And for those of you who have not read Donald Campbell's essays, Toward an Experimenting Society, I strongly urge you to do it, because it talks about the relationship between social experimentation and democracy.
Yeah, it's much older than democracy.
And from my point of view, I got it. I used to do mostly theoretical and longitudinal developmental research, and I didn't do intervention research. I was pretty politically active, but I didn't do intervention research. I slowly got into intervention research for two reasons. The first is some of the most important theoretical questions you can only test ethically in the context of interventions. We don't randomly assign kids to being exposed to violence, but we can randomly assign kids to being to a strategy that tries to limit exposure to their violence and their exposure to violence and test those things. That's one reason. The second is, and this is literally true, I believe that the experiments done well are one of the few ways children's voices can be heard in the din of what adults want to do about them. Okay? So if an experiment is set up right, we're actually taking fair readings about what the real impacts are in kids. And that is a very important corrective in the world of pure ideology, which is America, 40% of 40% of America is in right now. The Trumpers are only 16% of the nation, but they're 40% of the country that are Republicans. So, and so we could talk about that more sometime too.
Celestia. Thank you.
Do you have a question?
Hi.
Hi. My name is Apoorv Chauhan. I just finished my PhD with Cathy Campbell, and I work...
Who's she?
Sorry?
Who's
This is the one right next to you.
I'm teasing.
I work in a similar field. I work on poverty and social inequalities in terms of education and healthcare. And I was struck by the level of similarity in the context of Congo and where I work, which is in Bihar in India. So I have a couple of questions which are interrelated because I see a number of similarities.
Okay.
So as you may know, India runs the world's largest school feeding program, the Midday Meal Scheme, and they feed millions of children every day at schools. And in my research, I found that one of the basic determinants in a single community, which is what I researched, was that the basic appraisal of the policy itself, whether they thought it was good or it was rubbish. So if they thought it was rubbish, all the expected and planned outcomes, they all went down the drain. So what I was wondering is that did you sort of in the program assess how the stakeholders appraised the interventions themselves? And if so, did you find any significant impact of that?
We had no money to talk to parents.
Okay.
Another gigantic constraint of this study. We did have money, enough money to talk to teachers. We asked teachers their opinions about the balance between academic and social emotional learning and what children should do and things like that. That some of those go under the bucket of teacher motivation and teacher attitudes. Those are two drops in what should be a big bucket of areas of work related to that. So we did not look at it adequately in this study. In a preschool a teacher training for preschool teachers evaluation that we're in the middle of in Ghana, we've looked at that extensively, and we've drawn on some other people's research. And in general, as traditional as teachers are, they're not as traditional as parents in most African societies.
Yeah.
So teachers are considered the secularist, not in religious schools, but in state schools or in NGO or other kinds of schools, and the teachers are a little more traditional. We did have an impact on the use of physical punishment through a positive play-based training for preschool teachers, and on the teacher's part, and there was a huge backlash by the parents. The parents were concerned that the teachers were getting soft. They saw the kids' scores go up, they saw the kids happier, and they were still concerned that the teachers were soft. So that kind of dynamic, I think, is fundamentally important to puzzle through and work through. but we didn't address that as directly here as we are in Ghana.
Okay. Any other comments or questions before we wrap up?
Just very briefly, you've alluded to kind of trying to find statistical methods to get a causality with the data that you have.
Yeah.
I was just curious, I haven't done these things myself, but like, is it kind of Judea-Pearl or Rubens models, or would you just not have the data to do that?
There's kind of three general approaches that people are taking now. One is instrumental variable approaches. The instrumental variable approach requires the assumption it's the sole mediator.
Yeah.
It's causality by economists. You know, just assume a million wrong things, and then if you make that assumption, you can get a really good causal estimate on one parameter, conditioned on the assumptions. So, the second is something called principal stratification, and Heather at Harvard. I'll remember her last name. Is a big proponent of that. And then Guang Li, who's a statistician at the University of Chicago, is on to the, I think, the most advanced ways of thinking about it, the least restrictive in terms of assumption, the most robust. And she's in the middle of that. So G-U-O-N-G-L-I at the University of Chicago. Google her, and she'll send you into a world where you'll wish you had taken matrix algebra twice.
Well, Larry, all that remains is to thank you very much for your fascinating study.